Go ahead and open to Matthew. If you were with us last week, we kind of wrapped up Matthew 24. And kind of a nice little segue into Matthew 25. He's going to be continuing on with two more parables, ones that I hope that we will be able to get through today without having too long of a message. But we'll go ahead and read through those now, and then we'll take a look at them. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will be not enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. And afterward the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. For it will be like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, 'Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, and I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, 'Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' He also who had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, 'Master, I know you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours.' But his master answered him, 'You wicked and slothful servants, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.'" And he said, we'll do our best to work through both of these parables. It is interesting that Jesus, upon entering Jerusalem, he seemed to have begun his ministry there in the temple precincts, ministering to the Jews, with parables. After they had refused and they questioned the power that he had to do the signs that he was doing, to display through his prophetic actions the judgment that was going to befall the temple, he told them parables. Parables that indicted the Jews for their own rebellion, that they are like the disobedient son, that they are like the wicked tenants. They are like those who refuse to come to the wedding feast that God has prepared for them. And now, as we look at chapter 25, the parables that Jesus tells, concluding his indictment of the temple in Matthew 24 and the judgment that will befall the nation, the parables that he tells anticipate that coming parousia, the time which the Son of Man would be vindicated in the time that he urges his disciples to be on guard for, to be watchful for, to be waiting for, to be patient and enduring and faithful for. So he basically wraps up his public ministry, at least here with his disciples, with these parables. One we looked at last week, which was a shorter one. One that described a faithful and wise servant, and one that described the wicked servant. The wicked servant who takes advantage of the master's delay and seeks to beat his other servants and indulge himself in his master's goods. Where the faithful and wise servant is the one who simply rules over his household in his absence. He just simply dispenses the food that the master has given to provide for his other servants. Now here we have the parable of the 10 virgins and the parable of the talents. So I think, interestingly, thinking about the parable of the 10 virgins, what we see happening in this wedding ceremony or marriage feast or banquet or whatever you want to call it is very different than what we see happening in our marriage ceremonies. And we'll be able to draw out, I think, some of those differences as we work our way through this passage, because I think it's pivotal to understand what is actually happening here. The context of the first century marriage celebration helps us to see what is being displayed and described in the parable. But basically, the message is going to be the same as the previous parable. And we'll point that out too as we work our way through it. So what we see then, beginning in verse 1, is that this is a parable of the kingdom. Now, unlike the other kingdom parables that describe the kingdom's supernatural growth, the effect that the kingdom has, its small and seemingly insignificant origins and beginnings, and yet its rapid growth and its influence, like through the parable of the mustard seed or the parable of the leaven, this parable of the kingdom stresses the theme from the previous passage. One that probably gets our most attention today. The theme is that some will not be prepared for the coming of the kingdom. Some will not be ready when the kingdom comes. It's going to come suddenly and unexpectedly. So that is why his disciples are exhorted to pay attention, to not fall asleep, to be prepared, even in case of the master's absence or the bridegroom's absence. Or his delay. Now, the participants in this ceremony are described here as 10 virgins. This is quite a big wedding party. Most likely, these would be what we would call the bridesmaids. These are those who are friends of the bride, and their respective role is to go and to meet the bridegroom as he comes to get his bride and then bring her back to his home. So in a way, they're to meet him halfway, perhaps, and escort him to receive the bride, and then they all are to follow the bridegroom back into his home where they celebrate and feast for a week. A very long wedding ceremony. Now these 10 virgins, or 10 bridesmaids, they are split evenly down the middle, 5 of them being described as wise, and 5 as being foolish. Of course, this should, in our minds, call attention to the previous parable that we've already mentioned, where the servant of the master, one is described as being faithful and wise, and the other one is described as being wicked. So Jesus is using those two distinctions, those two polar opposites, to describe the bridesmaids. Now there is, as far as I'm concerned, no significance to the number of the bridesmaids here, even though some interpreters have assumed so. They try to find maybe a magic message in the number 10 or the significance of 10. I think Jesus is probably just drawing from a particular practice of his day. But it is significant that they are described as being faithful and wise, or being wise and being foolish. Now, the reasons why they are described as being wise or foolish is because of the fact that some of them are not prepared. Their preparedness is here described as being in case of the bridegroom's delay. Their preparedness referring to verses 3 and 4, where they each of them had 10 lamps, but only 5 of them had an extra flask of oil, just in case the bridegroom was delayed in his coming. Just in case it took him longer to go and rescue his bride than they had anticipated. The foolish bridesmaids did not have any extra oil. Now, what we see happening then, because of the way in which this is described, is that that is precisely the case. The crisis that exposes the foolish and the wise is, in fact, the delay of the bridegroom. One that the wise had took necessary precautions for, and one that the foolish did not. We see that in verse 5. And as the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. So they all had lamps, and they all slept. Now, I think in this context, the sleeping here is not necessarily the negative connotation that it had with the previous parables, and even with the previous exhortations that Jesus gave his disciples. I think we can draw that conclusion because both the foolish and the wise slept. And it's not necessarily that becomes the focus. That simply describes the delay that is taking place. They went out to meet the bridegroom, and he did not come when they expected him to come. In fact, he came actually seemingly a lot longer, or a lot later than they thought he had come, so that they actually fell asleep. They became drowsy and slept. So it doesn't carry the same negative connotation that we see in chapter 24, verse 42, where he exhorts his disciples to stay awake, or necessarily chapter 24, verse 44, where he describes and exhorts them to be prepared by being ready, being alert, staying on guard. Now, preparation here is not necessarily the fact that they fell asleep, it's the fact that they didn't have oil with them. They weren't prepared for the delay. Now, obviously here what's being described is not what we are familiar with in regards to a wedding ceremony. Typically, what we see happening in a wedding ceremony is that the groom is the first one to show up. The groom is the first one to walk down the aisle. The groom is waiting at the front for the bride and the wedding party to show up and celebrate with them. Now, that is typically how we see it taking place. And of course, we probably have our own historical reasons for that. But that is typically how the tradition is done. Everything is focused around the bride's arrival. Everybody is waiting for the bride to show up, for the bride to come down the aisle with that beautiful Enya song playing in the background. So that's how we experience wedding parties and wedding celebrations. So that a delay of a bridegroom, would be illogical to us. It doesn't fit into our traditions and our practices. This is something very different going on. Something very different, so that even in this case, the bridegroom is so late that the whole wedding party falls asleep. Now that we are aware that weddings, just like church services, never start on time. I think we're probably all familiar with that. I've never been to a wedding that started on time. I don't think I've ever been to a church service that started on time. But I don't think we've ever been so late that the people who are participating in that fall asleep. That seems to be quite odd. This is another indication that we're seeing just a completely different cultural practice than our own. And also the inclusion of the lights. Now, the lights here serve a very specific purpose. They're there meeting the bridegroom in the dark, late at night, even being prepared to meet him in the middle of the night, which is, in fact, when he shows up. That's why they bring the extra oil with them. Now, if you went to a wedding and you brought along your big Maglite flashlight, and if somebody asked you, why do you have a big Maglite flashlight with you? And you said, well, I'm just preparing in case the bride is late. Well, they would probably give you a very strange look and think that you're somehow a little bit off your rocker. But that is exactly the purpose here. They're going to meet the bridegroom. They're bringing their lights with them. They're going to meet him in the night, and they have extra oil in case he's really late. So what exactly was this practice? And I kind of already described it. Typically what would happen would be the bride would be waiting for the bridegroom to come and gather her and bring her back to his home. And this would happen on the first night of a week-long filled celebration and banquet and feasting and joy. And the only reason, and this is some speculation here, the only reason why the bridegroom would be delayed possibly could be due to the fact that they were haggling over the dowry, the price of the bride. And I think if I've understood that correctly, that usually was figured out beforehand, but this is what some commentators think. There is no reason given for his delay in the parable that Jesus is telling. But historically, what would happen is that there is this deal that is being taking place between the bridegroom's family and the bride's family about the price, the dowry price, or perhaps the presents that have been provided for the bride. Regardless of the reasons for his delay, Jesus is simply making the fact that there is a delay of the bridegroom. And that is what is going to catch the foolish bridesmaids off guard. They are not prepared for it. So, this is where we see their fatal mistake, the costly mistake of the foolish bridesmaids. The one that we've already been, it's already been hinted at in verse 3. They were foolish because they weren't prepared for the delay. At long last, if the bridesmaids became drowsy and fell asleep, they are awakened with the cry that the bridegroom has arrived. And they are beckoned to come and meet him. Here comes the bridegroom. This is their job. This is their job on behalf of their friends. This is their job on behalf of the bride herself. They're there to welcome the bridegroom and escort him to the bride's home. This is the purpose for being there in the town or in the country in the middle of the night with their lamps lit. So they hear the cry, they hear the shout of the announcement of the coming bridegroom, and they jump up and they get ready for the bridegroom, trimming their lamps, most likely relighting them, most likely applying more oil to them in case they had gone out while they slept. But the foolish bridesmaids, the ones who had not thought things through, had not prepared for the bridegroom's delay, had not brought along an extra flask of oil, they cannot keep their lamps lit. So they plead with the wise bridesmaids for some of their oil. But the wise bridesmaids have only brought enough for themselves. So, the foolish bridesmaids then explain that they didn't bring extra oil because they're trying to save the environment. And they attempt to heap guilt and shame on the wise bridesmaids for their excess. They lecture them with talks of equity and berate them for their obvious bridesmaid privilege. They start chanting, "Foolish bridesmaids, lives matter," and "My lamp, your oil," and "Reparations for no preparations." Now, it's interesting to actually see this play through, because obviously this is not describing our own days. And I think Jesus can upset some of our values, or our pretended values, with just the very parables he's telling here. So, what do the bridesmaids do? What do the wise bridesmaids do? They say, "Go get your own oil. Go and buy your own oil. We don't have enough to share with you. If we share with you, we're not going to have enough either. So go buy your own oil. You should have been prepared for this. You should have taken responsibility. This is your purpose here. If you cannot actually meet the bridegroom and escort him to the bride's home, you are actually bringing shame upon this union, and you're bringing shame upon your friend, the one that you are here representing and honoring. So go and buy oil for yourselves. Go to the dealers and buy for yourselves." So they are, in fact, are shamed because of their lack of preparation. And this is kind of where the story hinges upon. Because while they go and they buy oil for themselves, you know, why there's oil dealers, you know, awake and open in the middle of the night, I'm not sure. But apparently that is the case, because they go, and in their absence, the bridegroom shows up. While they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. So this is the conclusion the parable has been driving toward all along, right? The foolish bridesmaids have made a fatal mistake, and they miss out on the wedding feast. They were not ready. They were not prepared. And that's what I think Jesus wants us to see here. Those who are ready are the ones who are welcomed into the marriage feast. Now, second, I think he wants us to see that the door is shut on those who were not ready. The foolish bridesmaids who didn't prepare for the bridegroom's delay are not allowed into the marriage feast. I think that's a very striking note, I think, to this parable. And it does hint at something that is going on, you know, that speaks about something more than just a marriage ceremony here. Jesus is describing something completely different. The door was shut, so that when they came and then when they knocked and when they pleaded to be let in, that door was not going to be opened again. There's a note of finality here with this word. The door is shut and will not be opened. Well, obviously unusual for someone who shows up late to a party. I don't think that's typically how we practice things. They just have to sit in the back. A third, even though the foolish bridesmaids arrived at the marriage feast late and pleaded apparently with the bridegroom, they were not allowed to enter. The solemn declaration of the bridegroom is about far more than being late or unprepared. Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Now think about that for a second too. Think about, not only does the closing or the shutting of the door demonstrate the finality to this decisive moment, but it is far more about being prepared too. I don't know you. He doesn't declare that you were late. He doesn't declare that they weren't prepared. He doesn't declare and shame them for not taking responsibility. He declares that he doesn't know them. Again, I think that demonstrates that this parable is about more than a wedding ceremony. That's exactly why you see some of this language being repeated in Matthew 7. Some of the very same language we see in Matthew 7 is what we see here. The Lord declaring to those who profess to know him and profess to do things in his honor and by his power and for his name, but in fact, he never knew them. They are left on the outside. They are actually the ones who are cast into the darkness, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. For them, on that day of judgment, there would be no other opportunity, no second chance for them to change their minds and go back and be prepared. The door was simply shut, and they weren't allowed to come in. Now, I think the lesson of the parable comes through in verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. It's virtually the same statement we see in verse 36, verse 42, verse 44, verse 50. The same conclusion that we see happening at the end of the first parable. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and he will cut him into pieces. You see, this emphasis then stretching all the way from the beginning of Matthew 24, even back in Matthew 23, is this anticipation of this day of judgment that will befall this nation. And there will be some who are ready for it, and there will be some who will not be ready for it. And those who are not ready, they will be caught off guard. They will be caught unawares. Sudden destruction will befall them, and they will have no other way out. So that is Jesus' exhortation to his disciples, to be ready. And the idea here of introducing a delay seems to imply to them that it may take longer than you expected to take, which we know would actually be the case. Because in just a few days, in a few days after Jesus is crucified and resurrected, they're wondering about the timing of the kingdom. Is this going to be the time that you restore the kingdom to Israel? Is it going to happen now, Lord? Now that you've been crucified and raised up? And Jesus told them that it's not for them to know. It hasn't been revealed to them. And all of that implies, even in the language of Matthew 24, through the idea of the gospel going out to the oikumene, to the known world, to the Roman world, all of that implies a certain amount of time that's going to take place. And Jesus warns them that they need to stay vigilant for that period of time. They need to stay on guard. They can't grow lax and grow weary. They need to have oil that's going to actually provide for them in the moment when the bridegroom comes, because he will come at a time that they don't expect. But there will be some who are not prepared. There will be some who are not ready for the marriage feast, and they will be unable to enter and participate. I think why that is because of the judgment that will befall that nation. So what we see here then, I think, is not just a simple moralizing of a story like you need to be a good bridesmaid, which for half of us, that wouldn't really make any sense, and we would be embarrassed to have strived after being a good bridesmaid. It's the idea of preparation, specifically for the disciples. Jesus has not revealed to them the day or the hour. They know neither the day or the hour, so they need to be constantly vigilant. I think when we look at how this relates to us today, I think we will try to apply these things later on after we work through the second parable. Because there are general things that we can learn from this. But let's jump into the next one. The next one is a little bit longer, and it does have a little bit of a different flavor to it than the first two. The final parable here of the three is the parable of the talents. Now, the first parable described the master's unexpected return and judgment of the wicked servant. The second parable described the unpreparedness of the five bridesmaids for the bridegroom's arrival. Now, both of those parables emphasize the need for watchfulness, to be alert, to be prepared, to be vigilant in light of the master's and the bridegroom's delay or his absence, and in light of the sudden and surprising return, the sudden and surprising nature of the parousia. Now, this one has a slightly different emphasis. The master will be absent. In his absence, he will entrust his property to his servants. He is going to go on a long journey, and he will be gone for a long time. The emphasis is not necessarily on his sudden and surprising return. It's not necessarily that he's going to come and he's going to catch people off guard. But he's going to come and he's going to review his books, or how was it said? He's going to settle his accounts. Yeah, verse 19. He's going to come and he's going to settle his accounts. He's going to judge and assess his servants on whether or not they were faithful during his absence. So that is what this one is about. That is what this parable emphasizes. I think it's similar, the takeaway is similar than the first, or to the first two. Be ready to stay awake, to be vigilant, to be alert, to be watchful, to be on guard. Here, to be faithful, to be steadfast, to be about your master's business. So it is like, here, it is like, now this is interesting, is he referring back to verse 1, describing the kingdom parable, or is he referring back to verse 13, describing the unexpected and unknowableness of the day and the hour? Now, I think it could be taken in either way. It seems like this is another kingdom parable that describes something to do with the way in which the kingdom will come, the way in which the kingdom will be brought down upon the servants, the way in which the faithful servants will enter into the kingdom and be rewarded for their faithfulness. Now notice just a few things. The master bestows on his servants each according to his ability. So he gives the five talents to the one according to his ability, the two talents to the other according to his ability, the one talent to the other according to his ability. Well, the master recognizes the abilities and the giftings, the industry, the prowess of each servant, and entrusts them with his property accordingly. Now notice that he does not give the talents equally to each of the servants. Again, demonstrating that Jesus was not a socialist. Now, the talents here, obviously not referring to particular skills or superpowers that the master gave his servants. They already had ability. They already had power is the idea behind that word. They already had talents, at least as far as were concerned. Because that is the reason why Jesus gave them, or the master gave them, these respective amount of talents. He gave them something in addition to their abilities that they were going to use with their abilities to make a prosperous increase, or to make to double their money. Now, a talent here is something we've already been introduced to in one of the parables that Jesus told. Apparently, it was a weight that a soldier could carry on his back, and people estimated that a talent would be maybe 75 or 100 pounds. And obviously here that the talent is something of worth. This is a weight associated with some sort of currency. 75 or 100 pounds of gold or silver. Now, a talent by some degree of measurement would be worth 20 years of a laborer's wages. Now, we saw it in the parable of the unforgiving servant, when that one servant had a 10,000 talent debt forgiven him, but that he returned and responded to the person that owed him 100 denarii, that he would not forgive that small, piddly debt. 100 denarii, a denarii being a day's wages. A 10,000 talent debt is like the biggest number you could say in the Greek language. So what we're talking about here is an extraordinary amount of money. We're talking about a master who entrusts servants with an extraordinary amount. So think of 100 pounds of gold in our day, gold being $17 an ounce. 100 pounds of gold would be worth like $2.7 million. So in our day, that's how much value that would have. You know, think of a 20 years of salary being one talent. So five talents would be 100 years salary, right? Getting paid for 100 years worth of labor at the laborer's wage. So this is a very wealthy master, and he entrusts his servants with a lot. And notice that the servants, at least the first two, they quickly doubled their money. We're not sure exactly how they did that, but they immediately went out. They were given the gift. They immediately went out, and they got to work, and they doubled the amount that the master had given them. Of course, but the focus is always on the third servant. The third servant took his master's money, and he hid it in the ground. So he was a doomsday prepper with a very pessimistic eschatology. The first two servants were very optimistic. This is a lot of money. We can do a lot of good with this. We're going to work hard. We're going to labor, and we're going to actually make this prosperous. Jesting somewhat here, but I think you guys get the point. The third servant had a very different view of the master than the first two. I think that is kind of the pivotal point that we're getting at. Now, at long last, after a long time, the master comes back to settle his accounts with his servants. It looks virtually identical with the first two servants. So they present their doubling of the original talents. They give them and present them before the master. The master commends them. The master rewards, or perhaps even promotes them, and he invites them to share in his joy. He invites them to share in his pleasure. So the whole idea of the commending and the rewarding, well done, good and faithful servants, you have been faithful over a little, which it's interesting that the master describes the five talents, two talents as being a little. Enter into the joy of your master. I will make you faithful. I will put you over much. You think of the idea of them actually receiving a more prominent position based upon the fact that they were faithful over just a little bit is extraordinary. We're seeing really the character of the master in this. He is one who is sharing and trusting in his servants to do quite a bit. Quite a bit with all of his property in his absence, and quite a bit after he returns. After he comes back and he rewards them. He, just like Pharaoh and Joseph, he promotes Joseph and he gives them authority and power over the whole land of Egypt and over all of the stores and possessions of Egypt. So this is how the master responds to the faithful servants. They willingly and gladly increase the value of the master's property, and they were willingly and gladly presented it to him. This is for you. This is what we've done in your absence with what you've given us. They enter into their master's joy. Maybe a reference here to the marriage banquet. Reference here to the joy of the master's rule, the pleasure the master has in their success. They share in the master's pleasure. They desire and they strive to please the master, and they share in his pleasure. Now, unlike the previous two servants, the third servant comes and makes excuses. He views the master as harsh. You're a hard man. He claims to have feared him, so I was afraid. You're a hard man, I'm afraid. The master is hard and demanding, and the servant is paralyzed by his fear. He acts on the knowledge he has of the master. I know you to be a hard man. You're going to reap fields that you haven't even sown. You're going to harvest where you didn't plant. You're a hard, cruel man. So I hid your talent in the ground. So his service then is actually marked by inactivity. Driven by his fear, driven by his knowledge here of the master, he hid the talent in the ground. He buried it in the dirt. Again, we see that his understanding of who the master is actually drives him to do something that is not a faithful steward, that is not actually taking advantage of the gift that the master has bestowed upon him. He's simply not using it. He's not exercising it. He's not striving to do anything for the sake of the master. One author says this about it. He says, he's virtually calling his master a vicious tyrant, a capitalist who takes for himself the harvest that others work so hard on. He takes what he wants without caring who gets hurt in the process. Now, in the mindset of the third servant, he's saying, in light of who the master is, I'm just going to bury this in the ground. Afraid of who the master is, afraid that maybe he won't be able to get a return off of his investment if he does take it and try to invest the talents. But I think all of this comes apart when the master actually confronts him on this. So what we see here in this third part of the parable is the master responds to the third servant. He describes the servant as wicked and slothful, evil and lazy. And he points out the inconsistency of the master's excuse. Right? If he knew him to be hard, if he knew him to be a cruel man, one who reaps and gathers where he has not sown or scattered, then you think that fear would actually drive him to action. This is a guy who collects when he doesn't even plant or sow or scatter his seed. This is a guy who takes. This is a guy who grasps. This is a cruel, divisive man. He claims to be afraid of the master, but his actions show that he's not really afraid of the master. If the master is cruel like this, then you would expect this servant to actually be a little bit more diligent. You would expect this servant to do a little bit more with what he's been given. And the question the master poses to him just shows that he is simply being inconsistent. He's kind of contradicting, his actions contradict what he's saying to the master. He should have labored all the more for a profit. If you viewed me this way, this is what you should have done. You should have at least entrusted it to the bankers to make a little bit of interest. Now notice here, I think it's important that we recognize that the master is not, in this case, he's not agreeing with what the servant says about him or the way that the servant perceived him. He's not saying, yeah, I am a cruel man, and yeah, I do take stuff from other people's fields. He's just simply pointing out the fact that if you thought this way, then you should have done something different than what you did. And then what we see coming in verse 28 is something unexpected and something of a bit of a surprise. Verse 28, his talent is taken away and it's given to the first servant. So the talent, it's interesting here. He gives the talent to the guy who had 10 talents, and he describes that servant as having the 10 talents. So even though the first servant comes to the master and he says, you know, here is the talents, this is what I've made for you with what you've given me, he's actually here described as being in possession of that. So it's almost as if he's sharing in the wealth that he's created for his master. And now the master rewards him with something even more. It's a really a beautiful picture here. Even though the guy with the one talent is left with nothing. But that's the point of the parable. Here is a guy who did nothing with what God had given him, and he's left with less than nothing, right? Even what he had will be taken away. That's kind of the point of verse 29. For to everyone who has, more will be given. Obviously describing the first two servants. They will have an abundance. But for the one who does not have, even what they have will be taken away from them. I'm giving this talent to you. You just hit it in the ground and did nothing with it. I'm going to take it away and I'm going to give it to someone else. They end up with less than what they had at the beginning. So then we're struck with the idea of what is actually going on with these parables. It's easy to see, I think, in the parable of the 10 virgins, what's going on. Jesus is warning his disciples about the need for them to be prepared. Some are going to be caught off guard, and they're not going to be allowed to partake in the wedding feast that comes. They're not going to be allowed to partake in the kingdom that comes. They're not going to be allowed to share in the joy of their master because they will not be ready. They will be caught up in the cataclysm that's befalling Judea and Jerusalem. They will be left on the outside, and they will knock, and the master will come, and he will say, I didn't know you. So then what do we see happening with the parable of the talents? Now, I think our temptation is to look at it and, I think, to generalize it and to say, obviously he's talking about stewardship. He's talking about how God has gifted his children with unique gifts that they are to use for his glory. They are to use to advance his kingdom. They are to use to glorify and serve him. They are to be used within the church to build up the saints in the church. And of course, all of that is true. All of that is true because that is what God has done. He has, in one sense, he has rescued a bunch of unfaithful servants, and he has gifted them and equipped them with the Spirit to go out and to serve for his glory. That is the reason why we are here. We are here not because of ourselves and not for our own sake. We are here to serve and glorify and honor our Master. We are here to use the gifts that he's given to us, whether that be, you know, gifts in service or, you know, gifts in teaching or gifts in sacrifice and giving. We are to use what God has given to us. And in fact, if we look at it from one perspective, everything that we have is something that God has given to us. And we reuse that for his glory. And the master will come and he will assess and he will evaluate and he will determine whether or not you use those gifts in his honor and for his glory, and he will react and judge accordingly. He will settle his accounts with each of us individually with what we've done with what he's given to us. I think that is, in one sense, that is true. That is how God has created this world, and that is how God has equipped and gifted his people. It's a beautiful thing for God to lavish gifts upon us that we do not deserve to use for his sake and for his glory. What better thing can we do than to serve our King with what he's been given, what he's given to us? And how has he gifted us? How has he blessed us? How has he equipped us and given us of his Spirit and helped us to share in the new covenant blessings and be able to do that with his glory on our minds. I think, though, that this parable being addressed specifically to his disciples actually emphasizes something different. I think the concluding verse here in verse 29 It's the same verse you see almost verbatim in Matthew 13. In Matthew 13, when Jesus tells like 7 or 8 different parables about the kingdom, the disciples come to Jesus and they're like, explain to us, why are you talking in parables? Jesus, you're so confusing. Well, just state the truth clearly for us. We're dense. We're just fishermen. Why are you talking in parables? And what does he say to them? He says, to you, I'm given the mysteries, the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. But to others, it hasn't been given. To you have been given eyes to see and ears to hear. To you have been given the things that many prophets from long ago have longed to look into. They've longed to see what is actually happening in your day. And to you has been given this ability. To you will be known the secrets, the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. But to others, even though they see, they do not truly see, and they hear, they do not truly hear and understand, it hasn't been given. And I think that's where Jesus sees, that's where we see in Matthew 13:12, he explains that to them. The disciples have been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them, to the crowds, it has not been given. Why? Well, I think for the same reason we see happening here. At the end of this parable, verse 29, to everyone who has more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But for the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. So Jesus uses that same verse to justify his use of the parables. Something that the disciples are privileged to see and to hear and to understand, even so much that at the end of that chapter, Jesus asks them if they've actually understood the parables that he's saying. And they're like, yeah, we get it. And Jesus then describes them, that they will be like a well-trained scribe who is a master of a house, who continually brings out the old and the new, revealing the new things that God is accomplishing through his Son. They are the ones who bring forth the treasure of the king's house. If you go back to Matthew 7, then you'd say they are the ones who bring forth the fruit. They are the ones who attach to Jesus, abide in the vine. They're the ones who bring forth the fruit that demonstrates that they are the true sons of God. That they are the new 12 tribes. They are the new 12 rulers, the new people that God has created. And what have they been entrusted with? What have they been gifted with? Well, they've been gifted with the keys of the kingdom of heaven. They've been entrusted with the gospel that they're going to go out and proclaim in several short days. They've been gifted with this position of leadership. In fact, even so much that they will be responsible to judge the 12 tribes of Israel. They've been given places of honor in the master's house. They've been gifted the kingdom of God, right? Remember, the kingdom will be taken away and given to a people producing its fruits. So when you think about the parable then of the tenants, of the talents, they're the ones who have been entrusted with much. They're the ones who not only have the gifting, they're the ones who have understood the mysteries and the secrets of the kingdom of God, who've been entrusted with the positions of influence and leadership, service. They've been given the gift of the Spirit. They've been given the gift of the gospel, and they go out and they demonstrate their worthiness, I guess, or their faithfulness in following and serving the Master and producing more of the fruit that the Master has already produced in them. So I think looking at it from that perspective, then, the parable of the talents does, in one way, apply to us, at least generally speaking, in how we use the gifts that God has given to us. But it also applies directly, I think, to the apostles. They are the ones who've been entrusted with much, and their responsibility in this interim period of time is to go out, to use the talents that they've been given, to use the gifts that they've been given to produce more fruit for the king, to produce more for the master. And they're the ones who will be rewarded when the king, in his parousia, when the king is manifested, when the king is revealed. They will be the ones who are welcome to enter into his kingdom. Remember, that is the focus here. It is not just a judgment that's going to befall the rebellious, covenant-breaking nation, those who ask for the blood of Jesus to be upon their heads. It is not just a judgment that befalls them. It is the coming, the arrival of the kingdom of God. That is what they are striving to enter into. That is what they are working towards. That is what they are serving God for. Matthew 16 makes that clear. The same passage in Luke makes that clear. Luke 21. They will then, at that point, enter into the wedding feast and share in the joy of the Master, knowing that they have served him, and they were rejoiced because they were counted worthy to suffer for the sake of his name. So I think when we see this in that light, I think it gives us a little bit more of a concrete understanding of the purpose of the parable, specifically for his disciples. So we're going to pray, and then we will partake of communion together as we reflect upon what God has given us.